From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For thousands of years, wheat pretty much stayed the same. The wheat of the 17th century was the same as the wheat of the 18th and 19th centuries, but midway through the last century, wheat changed. In his book called Wheat Belly, the cardiologist William Davis says this iconic staple grain went through a drastic transformation. More drastic, he writes, than Joan Rivers. It was genetically stretched and sowed and engineered. And he says what we've been left with is a grain that is the real culprit in America's obesity epidemic. Today in the program, Davis is joining us to make his case for how wheat, pretty much all modern wheat, whole grain versions too, are making us fat and hungry. Join us after the news. Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Early January is the perfect time to talk about the American diet, as most Americans are rethinking what and how they eat. So today, we're taking up the subject as we jumpstart our series on health and fitness, and we're going to start today with wheat. Many of you have heard about the best-selling book Wheat Belly by Dr. William Davis. Davis has been making this case that the real problem with the diet and health of most Americans is not fat, it's not sugar, it's not the rise of the internet or the demise of the agrarian lifestyle. The real problem, he says, is wheat. Davis's book is a kind of biography or natural history of wheat, and he explains how the wheat that most of us recognize and eat is not really the same thing as our grandmothers knew as wheat. Davis says modern wheat is the transformed product of genetic research, and this change came really in the last 40 years or so. Davis contends that this modern wheat is a grain that is the culprit in America's obesity epidemic. It's messing with our blood sugar levels. It's accelerating the process of disease and aging, not to mention its effects on our digestive systems. William Davis is joining us today to talk about Wheat Belly, and we invite you to join us as well. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. William Davis is a preventive cardiologist and author of Wheat Belly, as well as the Wheat Belly Cookbook, his new book, the Wheat Belly 30 Minutes or Less Cookbook. He's joining us today from a studio in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And Dr. Davis, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I wanted to begin with, you write about kind of your own personal experience with wheat in the book. I guess you have a kind of a wheat sensitivity, but you write about how you have a long and close personal relationship with wheat. Talk about your relationship with wheat, first of all.
Sure, Doug. I've got my share of scars from this thing. 25 or so years ago, I heard a colleague of mine talk about the wonders, the value of cutting fat out of the diet. I'm a cardiologist, of course, and so I'm interested in preventing heart disease. And he was talking about how wonderful it was to cut out fats and animal products from the diet. And I thought that was kind of cool. This was a time in my career when all I wanted to do was angioplasty and stents and those kinds of fancy heart procedures. So I was naive about diet. I gave it a try. I gained 30 pounds. My triglycerides in my cholesterol panel went to 350. My HDL dropped to 27, which is very low and associated with high risk for heart disease. And I became diabetic. And Doug, I was jogging 3 to 5 miles per day. So it took that hard lesson for me to start asking, well, what in the world could have happened if I cut my fat, did everything that I thought was right, and exercised, yet everything went wrong? Yeah. Well, I became non-diabetic just by stopping all that way of life. But I started to think and started to question a lot of the lessons that were given: cut your fat, cut your saturated fat, that exercise is a cure for all these things. And many years later, I stopped doing heart procedures and I focused only on heart disease prevention and even reversal. And there's a simple fact, and that is, if you really want control over heart disease risk, you can't have high blood sugars. Very simple, well-established fact. You can't be diabetic. You can't be pre-diabetic. You can't even have blood sugars a little bit above normal. So I used a very, very simple, simple-minded observation, and that is if you look at any table of glycemic index, that is how high blood sugars go after various foods, you'll see – if you look closely, you'll see that whole wheat has among the highest of glycemic indexes, higher than nearly all other foods. So I asked patients to take wheat products out of their diet to try to drop their blood sugar naturally.
Right.
People did it. They were puzzled by this at first, but they did it. 3 months later, they'd come back and their blood sugars would be lower. But they would say, you know what? Why do you think I lost 38 pounds? Why do you think my waist shrunk by 4 inches? Why is my asthma so much better I was able to throw away my 2 inhalers? Why is my depression so much better? I'm off 2 antidepressants. Why is my rheumatoid arthritis so much better? I'm off 3 drugs. Why did my acid reflux go away within 5 days? Why did the bowel urgency of irritable bowel syndrome disappear within 5 days? Why did my leg swelling go away? Why did I get so lightheaded I had to stop my blood pressure medicines? In other words, what started out as a very simple experience to reduce blood sugar turned into an experience of witnessing transformations in health.
You know, it's one thing to go after highly processed wheat, that, you know, that fine flour that makes stuff like Wonder Bread and Pop-Tarts. But you're talking about, and we're going to get to this as we go, but you're talking about all modern wheat for the most part, whole wheat or sort of whole grain wheat included. But one thing you acknowledge in the book is that there seems to be this kind of taboo associated with criticizing wheat. It can seem absurd, you write, even unpatriotic. So how are you dealing with that part of it, and what kind of reaction are you have you been getting, at least in that sense?
You're exactly right. So wheat has this halo around it, doesn't it? It's got the blessing of the USDA, the U.S. Dietary Guidelines for Americans, because we have 14 epidemiologic studies that have proven, and this is without question, that whole grains are less bad than white flour. That's true. If I replace white processed flour products with whole grains or whole wheat products, I will have less risk for heart disease, diabetes, weight gain, and colon cancer. That's true. Unfortunately, the flawed logic used, that is, you replace something bad with something less bad and there's an apparent benefit, was used by agencies like the USDA, U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, to conclude that whole grains must therefore be good in unlimited quantities. What they didn't ask is, well, what happens if we remove it entirely? So we have to look outside of those 14 epidemiologic studies to understand that. Mm-hmm. When you do – and by the way, those data exist. There's quite a bit of it. When you look at those data, you see transformations in health exactly mimicking what I saw in real life. Now, the reception this has gotten has, to my surprise, been overwhelmingly positive, even though it goes against the – forgive me – the grain of conventional thinking.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead, Doctor. I'm sorry.
And I think it's because – and I don't think it's me, Doug. I don't think it's my great charisma or powers of persuasion. I think it's what people are experiencing. In the age of social media, people are saying, well, you know what? I thought it was kind of kooky, but I did it. And I'll be damned. I lost 40 pounds. I lost 80 pounds. And my arthritis is gone, and my lupus has improved so much, and the rash I had for 15 years is now gone. It's the experiences that people are having and then sharing with other people.
You say in the book that this shift from harvesting wild grain I want to talk about the history, I guess, is what I'm talking about, because the wheat we all consume now is not the same kind of wheat from earlier human history, not the wheat of our ancestors, is how you put it in the book. So give us a sense of that. What do we know about the first wheat, for example, that we humans encountered? Because you say in the book, in some ways, it was kind of like a wild grass.
Exactly right. So wheat is a grass, as is corn and rice, and now, the grass that humans first turned to, called wheat, was really einkorn wheat, an ancient 14-chromosome naturally occurring form of wheat. Humans turned to this grass in desperation because this was a time, 10,000 years ago, when there was natural climate change. It was increasing temperature and dryness, and humans were running short of the things they normally regarded as food, like meat and organs and mushrooms and berries and nuts. We saw the food being eaten by the ancient cows, aurochs, and goats, ibex, and asked, can we eat that too? So we tried. Well, what happens when humans try to eat grass? We get sick. We throw it up. We pass it out in diarrhea. We get stomach aches, etc. So it took us a while. Us clever humans, those clever people, figured out that you couldn't eat the roots, nor the stalk, nor the leaves, but you could eat the seed, and then only if you pulverize, dry it, and heat it. And we made porridge out of it. So we figured out that we could eat the seed. Well, fast forward many years, wheat went through many changes, both naturally and in the hands of humans. And now wheat is a 42-chromosome plant, not the 14-chrome. You know, we have 46 chromosomes. A baboon or orangutan has 48 chromosomes. So a chromosome or two can make a big difference. Yeah. So modern wheat's a 42-chromosome plant. Now, we reached the 20th century as this 42-chromosome plant, but largely changed by traditional means. When agribusiness entered the picture, Doug, that's when everything really changed.
You refer to wheat as one of those iconic dietary staples, and it seems like we've given a kind of symbolic importance to wheat. You point out in the book, it's in the Bible, for example. It's central to these religious rituals. It's part of our language. In fact, you say it's kind of been deeply a part of the human experience. So it seems like when you're talking about something like trying to resist wheat, try to take it out of your diet, you're up against a lot of human history here.
That's right. So it is part of the history of agriculture. It's material to all the things that led to the trappings of society. So it's really a fascinating story that parallels the human experience. So it really, you know, wheat is just an innocent grass. There's nothing intrinsically bad about this thing. It's what we have come to perceive it as. Now, the astounding thing is it's become 20% of all human calories, this seed of a grass. And by the way, corn and rice are also seeds of grasses. Now the human population on this earth obtained 50% of all human calories from the seeds of grasses, an astounding departure from the adaptive diet of humans.
Let me ask you, I want to go back a little bit. You mentioned this sort of evolution, how we transformed it, we altered it. First, it was this relatively genetically simple sort of thing, and then we began to change it. It became emmer. Is it emmer or is it emmer wheat?
Emmer wheat.
Emmer wheat. So it became emmer wheat eventually, and that was popular for thousands of years. And this particular strand was probably, you say, the wheat that Moses was referring to in the Bible. It was the wheat that would have been used during the Roman Empire. It flourished in Egypt. Do we have any sense of what that was like? What it tasted like? Or because I like the story you tell in the book about this organic farmer you found who kind of devoted herself to cultivating these ancient forms of grain.
Sure. So the original wheat, einkorn wheat, a 14-chromosome wild plant, mated naturally, not the hands of humans, but mated naturally with another grass. Wheat's a grass. It can mate with other grasses.
Yeah.
So einkorn mated with another grass, and plants have this peculiar capacity to combine chromosomes. So if as a human, I have a mate and we each contribute 46 chromosomes to our offspring, the child does not have 92 chromosomes. So plants can do that. Plants can combine. That's called polyploidy. So einkorn combined with a wild grass, 14 chromosomes apiece, and the offspring was emmer wheat, a 28-chromosome plant. That's the wheat of the Bible, of Egypt. These wheats, by the way, I've been wheat-free for a number of years, and if I have modern wheat again, I get very ill for several days. So, but for the sake of science and literature, I exposed myself to several forms of wheat a few years back, and I did have bread that I made of einkorn and emmer. It's very different, particularly the einkorn. Einkorn bread smells like peanut butter. It's very dense. It doesn't rise very well. It's very tasty, by the way. Likewise, emmer. It's a denser, nuttier kind of bread, almost unrecognizably different from modern ideas of breads that come from modern wheat. So now this happened again. Emmer wheat mated with another wild grass that contributed another 14 chromosomes, so 14, 14, 14. That brings us to the 42-chromosome strains of wheat, such as spelt. and then now the modern triticum strains that have led to the wheats we have now in the store shelves.
So for most of this time, so we get to triticum, and that, and for most of this time, there was a kind of gradual change. You mentioned the wheat of the 17th century was the wheat of the 18th century, and it was pretty much the same as the 19th. And then we move into the 20th century, and this marks the major change that you really get at in your book. You write about what you call this upheaval and hybridization methods that really changed it. Talk about this part.
Sure. So, Doug, these were noble efforts. These were not evil, revenue-driven efforts. These were scientists in agriculture who were interested in increasing yield per acre. They were worried about world population growth and starvation. And so scientists, particularly those working in Mexico of all places at a research foundation driven by the Rockefeller Foundation, worked on developing high-yield strains of wheat. And one of the most involved scientists was Dr. Norman Borlaug, and he helped develop the high-yield semi-dwarf strain of wheat. This is a strain of wheat that stands 18 inches tall, not the usual 4.5 or 5 foot tall stalk of wheat. Its shaft is very thick and large. Its seed is exceptionally large, and the seed head, the length of the collection of seeds, is very long. So this was a very high-yielding strain. So they obtained this by multiple hybridizations. They also mated wheat with other grasses to introduce unique genes. And then after the work of Borlaug and his colleagues, there are the techniques of mutagenesis, the purposeful induction of mutations using chemicals, X-ray, and gamma rays. Now, this all predates the age of genetic modification, genetic engineering. I point that out because the wheat industry does not like me very much. We'll say Davis says that wheat has been genetically modified. It has not. Well, they're correct. They're in that wheat has not been genetically modified. It was changed by other methods, methods that were often imprecise and crude and difficult to control, that in many cases were worse than genetic modification. They didn't tell you that part. So we have these modern strains of wheat on the store shelves now, the product of high-yield semi-dwarf strains. There's a very fundamental difficulty in agribusiness and agriculture nowadays, and that is no matter how extreme the change is introduced into a plant, no matter what methods were used, even bizarre methods, there is no question about its suitability for human consumption. You can go from laboratory to grocery store shelf with no questions asked. And that was true with wheat, of course. Mm.
So it's interesting with you talk about how, as you say, there was a noble intent here to increase yields, decrease production costs. It made sense. But you say the problem with all this messing around with wheat was that virtually no questions were being asked about whether or not this was compatible with human health.
Absolutely. Pardon me. So just one hybridization event, Doug, can change dozens of proteins. It may only be an amino acid or two in that protein, but that can be enough to change the properties of that protein and its effect on humans. So for instance, we know for a fact that the gliadin protein of wheat, gliadin is a protein within gluten. That's the protein that has been associated with celiac disease and other conditions. We know that the gliadin protein in 1960 is very different, was very different than the gliadin protein of 2014. For instance, there's a protein, a form of gliadin that comes from the gene GLIA alpha 9 that is almost absent in the wheat of 1960 and is now present in most strains of wheat 2014. And that's the gene that has been most closely associated with celiac disease. And we know that celiac disease has quadrupled in the last 50 years, doubled in the last 20 years. So we have the appearance, the enrichment of this gene in wheat for gliadin. Alongside of it, we have a quadrupling of celiac disease. Mm-hmm. Now, this is about a lot more than celiac disease, but that's kind of the canary in the coal mine. It tells us changes have been made and people are experiencing diseases from it.
There's this image that you invoke in your book, or images anyway, of these photographs that people look at. And you hear this from time to time, you know, looking at photographs from the 50s or the 60s, even the 70s. People, you know, let's say it, much thinner than we see in images from, you know, from modern photographs, and that contrast, you say, can really be explained in part by the increased consumption of this genetically, or this altered anyway, hybridized modern wheat?
I would, yes, I think so. And the increased consumption of foods made from wheat, because we've all been told that we should cut our fat and eat more healthy whole grains. And so people have followed that advice and consume more products made of wheat, because most people don't hear eat more millet or buckwheat, right? They eat more wheat products. So Americans have followed the advice they were given. Now, the important thing to know that explains a lot of this is, so we know that gliadin protein was changed, mm-hmm. and one of the consequences was an increase in celiac disease, but it was also changed in ways that allows it now to yield opiates. 4, 5, and 6 amino acid long peptides, small pieces from the gliadin protein upon digestion that bind to the opiate receptors of the human brain. They don't make us high though. They don't provide pain relief like morphine or OxyContin. They only stimulate appetite and have other peculiar mind effects that vary depending on your susceptibility. So for instance, if you have a tendency towards schizophrenia, it causes paranoia. If you have a tendency towards depression, it causes depression. If you have bipolar illness, it triggers the mania. If you have attention deficit disorder or autistic spectrum disorder, it causes difficulty with attention span and behavioral outbursts. If you have a tendency towards bulimia or binge eating disorder, it causes 24-hour-a-day intrusive food obsessions. But you and me, without those conditions, it tends to only cause mind fog and appetite stimulation. Mm. So when these new forms of gliadin were introduced into the food supply, which is the early to mid-80s, we saw calorie consumption increase about 440 calories every day, 365 days per year. Mm. It increases appetite. It increases appetite specifically for carbohydrates,
yeah.
chips, cookies, not for lamb chops.
So let's be clear about what you're saying here, because you mentioned how food scientists in some ways kind of actually stumbled upon this gliadin about 25 years ago, and that I guess you're saying this, that in some ways they deliberately manipulated this protein to get the American public to eat more carbohydrates, more food?
Well, I have to admit that's my suspicion. I don't have proof. I think I almost had proof, but I don't really have proof. But I don't know of any other way. Doug, I know of no other way to account for the fact that wheat is in almost everything now. 1960, you and I go up and down the supermarket aisles. We ask, what foods contain wheat? Mm. We see it in bread, pancake mix, and rolls, right?
Yeah.
2014, we go up and down the supermarket aisles. We find it in bread, pancake mix, and rolls, and licorice, salad dressings, taco seasoning, tomato soup, instant soup mixes, all frozen dinners, breakfast cereals, salad. In other words, we would turn to each other and say, well, gee, we can't find anything that doesn't have wheat in it. And I can't believe that wheat is that necessary for taste and texture in things such as salad dressing. It does have some useful characteristics for the food industry, but I think it's been put there because smart food scientists pieced this together before I did and said, hey, you know, with this new form of wheat seems to have an appetite-stimulating effect. It makes people want a whole lot more. Let's put it in everything. And you know the rest of the story. We watch the American public grow. We watch them increase calorie intake from carbohydrates, which then leads to the visceral obesity epidemic, diabetes, etc.
Dr. William Davis is with us. He's a preventive cardiologist, author of the books Wheat Belly and Wheat Belly, 30 Minutes or Less, the cookbook, which just came out last month. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're jumping back into our fitness and health series. Diet, of course, on the minds of most of us right now. So in the coming months, we'll be talking about various theories related to how and what we eat. We're beginning with wheat. Our guest is Dr. William Davis, the author of the very popular book called Wheat Belly. He has a book that came out about a month ago, new, called The Wheat Belly 30 Minutes or Less Cookbook. He's joining us from a studio in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So I want to talk about some of the reasons wheat is – because you say this in the book, and people ask you, look, why pick on wheat? You've got high fructose corn syrup that seems problematic, people are saying. But you identify particular things to wheat that are unique and problematic. One is, of course, this gliadin that you mentioned. Another is this – that you say few foods really increase blood sugar like wheat can. In fact, you say that if it's a false choice in some ways, but you say if you had to choose between a Snickers bar, for example, and a couple of slices of bread, you'd say it's probably better to choose the Snickers bar?
Yes, I would say that. So you're exactly right. What I'm not saying is wheat is the only problem in the American diet. Of course, there are other problems. High fructose corn syrup is a problem. Yeah. Corn starch is a problem. So there are other problems. But at the base of a lot of these problems is wheat. And let me explain. Yeah. It's that gliadin protein, this thing that stimulates appetite for carbohydrates. So people will say, I don't have a problem with wheat. I've got a sweet tooth. What I tell them is, no, you've got a wheat tooth. In other words, you take the wheat out of the diet. And more often than not, people say, you know what? You're right. I don't crave sweets anymore. In fact, when I have that thing I used to love, whatever it was, you know, what's that ice cream they have with coffee, cookie bits in it?
Yeah. Ben and Jerry's cookie. Yeah.
They'll say it was sickeningly sweet. Yeah. I couldn't even eat it. So there's something that changes taste, perception, appetite that really almost self-corrects diet. It's not always true, but it's true for the majority.
One of the issues, of course, is intestinal problems, what you call the gastrointestinal battleground. What's going on with wheat and our digestive systems?
If we had to craft a perfect gastrointestinal poison, it would be a sandwich, because there are several components in wheat that make it toxic for the human gastrointestinal tract. So that gliadin protein, for instance. See, these are the products of the seeds of grasses, and we can't eat grass. And that remains true for the components of the seed. That is, most of the components of the seed of wheat are indigestible. We can't eat the roots, we can't eat the stalk, nor can we eat this. We can eat the seed, but we can't digest it. We can digest the amylopectin, that's the carbohydrate of the seed of wheat. But we can't really digest a lot of the other proteins. There's a protein, for instance, called wheat germagglutinin. It's a very large four-part structure that is completely, completely impervious to human digestion. And it's highly toxic to the human gastrointestinal tract. If I feed 1 milligram, which is just a speck, to a rat, a laboratory rat, its intestinal tract is destroyed. And the average American who consumes lots of healthy whole grains gets about 10 to 20 times that amount. So that's one component, wheat germagglutinin. Mm. That gliadin that is partially digested to 4 or 5 amino acid long pieces. And by the way, proteins when they're digested, say proteins in hamburger or an egg, are digested to single amino acids, but not the proteins in wheat. They're digested at best, this gliadin protein, to 4 or 5 amino acid long pieces. Now those are the pieces that become opiates. But some of the gliadin remains intact. And that is highly toxic to the human gastrointestinal tract. It causes abnormal increases in intestinal permeability. And this applies, by the way, to virtually everybody. This is not just people with celiac disease. This is independent of celiac disease. That increased intestinal permeability is the first step in autoimmunity. It's the first step that triggers all the things that happen when you have rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, polymyalgia rheumatica, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, multiple sclerosis, and about 200 other conditions. The first domino in that effect is the indigestible form of the gliadin protein of wheat. There's also the leptin blocking effect. That is that wheat germagglutinin blocks the hormone leptin. Leptin is the hormone that tells you and me, you've eaten enough, stop. Well, wheat germ agglutinin turns off that hormone. So you keep on eating even after you've eaten more than enough for sustenance.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones. Dave is with us, calling from Logan, Utah. Dave, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just had a quick comment on the idea that the appearance of wheat in much of the food stuff that we consume is the result of a conspiracy. I'm loath to believe in conspiracy theories in general, but in this case in particular, doesn't it seem to you and your guests that it's more likely that wheat is so ubiquitous because of the economics involved with wheat? Wheat breeding in our society has created an ingredient that's cost-effective to include in all of the foods that we eat. It just seems very difficult for me to believe that the appearance of wheat in all these foods is the result of a coordinated conspiracy by food scientists.
Let's make it clear. You did say, Dr. Davis, that it was a hunch, wasn't anything you had proof of, that people were manipulating gliadin to increase appetite. But it's a good question. How do you respond?
Dave is absolutely right. This is my speculation, for which I have no proof. That's a tough thing to prove. You know, it was tough to prove that big tobacco conspired, right, to increase the content of nicotine in cigarettes until the internal documents became public upon discovery during the lawsuits. So a very, very tough thing. This is my raw speculation. Dave may be right. This is simply the evolution of the market, that industry found that it was cheap, easy, and commoditizable. That is, obtainable in large quantities. It has a shelf life that's measured in years, not like a tomato, just a few days, or a banana. You can ship it by transoceanic liner, and it doesn't go rotten. And people don't care whether that wheat came from Saskatchewan, Kansas, or the Ukraine. So it is the perfect food that acts as a commodity. So this is the perfect food also for big agribusiness to profit from, just like you profit from petroleum or iron ore. You can't commoditize organic tomatoes or eggs from pasture-raised chickens, but you can commoditize the seeds of grasses as food, wheat, corn, and rice. Now 50% of all human calories, now controlled by a top-down system.
Dave, thanks. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Pauline sends this email. She says, I hope you're clear that belly fat from wheat is a generalization, Pauline says, and not the case for everyone. I myself, she says, I'm almost 60. I've always eaten lots of whole wheat. I avoid white flour, but not 100%. I am not a thin person, but I am fit, she writes. The best feature on my body is that I always have a good flat stomach. So I'm sure you hear that all the time, people saying, I eat plenty of wheat. I seem to be pretty fit. So how do you respond to that? It's a good question.
Well, fitness and fatness are two different things, right? So you can be 280 pounds at 5'7" and be still pretty fit. So these are two independent things. And there is variation. If I feed somebody, let's say, lots of sugar, the fat you gain may be different from the fat someone else gains. Some people gain it, of course, in their backside. Some people gain it in their abdomen. But the abdominal fat, the visceral fat, is really the signature form of fat. Not everybody gets it, but most people do get it. And that's a unique fat, Doug. It's visceral fat that's highly inflammatory, behaves differently. For instance, it's visceral fat that comes from carbohydrate consumption, including the amylopectin of wheat, that has peculiar hormonal effects. It expresses, for instance, an enzyme called aromatase. And in men, aromatase from visceral fat converts testosterone to estrogen. So testosterone goes down, estrogen goes up. Alongside that, prolactin, for unclear reasons, goes up, probably because of pituitary disruption. So males experience an increase in prolactin, prolactation, a drop in testosterone, and a rise in estrogen. So they get reduced libido, they get depression, and they get man breasts. Similarly, females get those same kinds of changes. Their breasts get larger, believe it or not, with wheat, but they also are exposed to greater breast cancer risk because this thing is very unnatural. So visceral fat's a very special fat. Not everybody gets it, but most people do.
Yeah. We're getting a lot of questions related to sprouted wheat, local wheat, older varieties, organic, you know, non-GMO wheat, spelt, for example. Amy writes about spelt, for example. Has that been equally messed with? Yeah, I think people are looking for something they can replace bad wheat with good wheat, but respond to that, if you would.
Well, every step we go back in time, wheat gets more and more benign. If we go back to the wheat of 1960, it's less harmful than the stuff we've got. If we go back to the wheat of 19th century, it's a little less harmful. Go back to spelt or kamut of the Middle Ages, mm-hmm. even better. If we go back to emmer, the wheat of the Bible, it's even less harmful. All the way back to einkorn. Here's the question, though. Is there a strain – is there a time or a strain of wheat where it's completely benign?
Yeah.
No. There's always a price to pay. For instance, you know, this is I find this incredible. Anthropologists are endlessly fascinating people. Ask them, what happened when primitive humans first consumed wheat, or for that matter, any seed of a grass like corn or maize? And they'll tell you, oh, we've known for decades that when humans first turned to the seeds of grasses, grains, they developed explosive tooth decay. Prior to the consumption of grasses, Doug, there was virtually no tooth decay. 0.4% of all teeth recovered prior to the consumption of grasses, seeds of grasses, showed tooth decay. When we started to eat grains, 16 to 49% of all teeth recovered showed decay. It varies depending on what time of the world, what part of the world, what time of history, et cetera. So tooth decay, tooth loss, deep infections of the mouth, tooth crowding, crooked teeth, changes in maxillary bone and mandibular structure, and iron deficiency appeared for the first time. You know, the disease hemochromatosis, the gene for hemochromatosis shared by about 67% of people of Northern European descent is believed to be an adaptation that partially counteracts the iron blocking effect of wheat consumption. So it's a partial effort to adapt to the maladaptive effects of wheat. So there's never been a time where wheat was entirely benign. Now, is that good enough though? Maybe some people will say, well, you know what? I can accept some of the problems like high blood sugar and iron deficiency of eating even the ancient forms. My personal response is, well, gee, if you want ideal health, why not get rid of this thing that never belonged in the human diet in the first place?
One of the arguments that you hear of course, is this about the obesity epidemic is that Americans are just less active than they used to be. That maybe wheat was a function here, maybe sugar is a function here too, but life before was just more rigorous and physical. Women spent more time and energy maintaining households, men as well, and, you know, shoveling snow and cooking and ironing and wringing. I mean, fewer labor-saving devices. I mean, do you throw that into the equation? Because you hear that as one of the arguments. Look, it's not just wheat, Dr. Davis. It's our lives. It's our lifestyle.
I think there are factors here beyond wheat. Of course there are. But I would make this point. You know what? Most of the people I talk to are hardworking, conscientious people who are attentive to issues about health. They've cut their fat, they've eaten more healthy whole grains, and they cannot understand why they've gained 48 pounds or have become pre-diabetic or have to take antidepressants and acid reflux drugs. This I'm astounded by the masses of people now who have experienced complete turnarounds. Now, people say, oh, that's all just anecdote. Mm-hmm. What's surprising to me is that there really is an astounding amount of science here already. In other words, this is not based purely on anecdote. There's a lot of science here already. That's why in the very first Wheat Belly book, there's 16 pages of references. I'm writing another book that'll come out in fall. I'm up to 60 pages of references. The science is very deep, and all I did was put it all together. So there are many things. There's lots of science here backing up these arguments.
What about the argument that you hear that diets that eliminate entire food groups are just harder to maintain than more sort of balanced diet types? You know, a lot of people end up falling off the wagon because it's just too hard to sort of balance everything out. I mean, do you argue that you could be more temperate in the way you go, you know, less wheat, a couple of things every once in a while? Or do you just say, look, just ditch it all?
I find that people who get rid of it entirely do better. I would liken this to saying to your neighbor who's an alcoholic, John, I think drinking 2/5 of vodka a day is bad for your health. I think you should cut it back to 3 shots. You know what? You're right. It would be better for his health, but he can't do it because it's the addictive factor here, right? It's that gliadin protein that provides opiates. People have a real heck of a time just cutting back. They're tortured by it. And so I see people who try to cut back still struggle with all these problems, appetite stimulation, autoimmunity, high blood sugars, et cetera, and the desire for carbohydrates. So the cleanest, most effective strategy I find is to get rid of it entirely. And by the way, I should mention, when people get rid of wheat abruptly, 40% of people will experience a withdrawal syndrome, an opiate withdrawal syndrome. It's fatigue, headache, nausea, and depression. And it lasts about 5 to 7 days. Thankfully, everybody survives. It can be very unpleasant for some people. And I don't know of any way to not have it. There are things you can do to soften it, like hydrate and use salt. I ask people to use probiotics, for instance, take magnesium supplements, and it tends to smooth the effect, but it can still be quite an unpleasant process. But people come out of it feeling wonderful. It ends fairly abruptly, and you feel wonderful. And that's when all the great stuff starts to happen. That's when joint pain starts to disappear in your hands and wrists. That's when acid reflux and bowel urgency from irritable bowel syndrome disappears. And then over a longer period, a lot of those other wonderful things happen. But it's a lot easier, I think, to get rid of it and experience even that withdrawal than to torture yourself with little nibbles and bits and pieces and continue to provoke these effects.
Dr. William Davis is with us, preventive cardiologist, author of the books Wheat Belly and the Wheat Belly 30 Minutes or Less Cookbook, which just came out last month. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. William Davis. We're talking about the effects of wheat. Wheat Belly is the name of his book. That's an extremely popular book, bestseller, of course. He also has a new book out, a cookbook, the Wheat Belly 30 Minutes or Less Cookbook, which just came out about a month ago. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Tom is with us in Salt Lake. Tom, hi.
Good morning, Doug.
Morning.
I wanted to ask the doc, does he have any peer-reviewed, controlled studies that would show that simply the elimination of wheat only will produce all of the wonderful changes that he cited at the first of the program?
Yeah, this is the clincher, right? Peer-reviewed evidence, something independently created. What do you say?
Yes, there's actually an astounding amount of research already done. There's a lot of unanswered questions, but there's a lot already answered. So we have a large clinical trial, for instance, in rheumatoid arthritis. If you remove wheat, there's marked improvement. Not in everybody, but in the majority. There are several small studies in children with ADHD and autism. And there's remove wheat and there's an improvement in behavior. There's a study in IgA nephropathy, a kidney disease. There's improvement. In other words, we have about 24 studies where wheat was removed and various health benefits develop. What we don't have is a really large study, let's say 10, 20,000 Americans who have only removed wheat and then compared to a control group, and we watch them over a long period. Now, interestingly, almost no diet has that. So you would think, for instance, that the USDA food pyramid is based on such a clinical trial. It's not. How about the American Heart Association diet, the TLC diet? Is that based on a large clinical trial? It's not. How about the American Diabetes Association diet? Is that based on a clinical trial? It is not. It's based on bits and pieces. So this does have science behind it, though like virtually all other diets, lacks a very large clinical trial.
Thanks very much for the call. 801-585-WEST, again, the number 2 to join us. What's wheat brain?
Well, there are components of wheat that have varied effects on the brain. In fact, my friend, Dr. David Perlmutter, has a book called Grain Brain, and he talks a lot about that. His focus is the dementia, not just from wheat, but also from carbohydrates because of glycation and the effects of high blood sugars. But there's more to this than high blood sugars. We know, for instance, the Mayo Clinic has a small trial where they identified gluten encephalopathy, dementia from wheat, fatal dementia from wheat, proven at autopsy. So it leads to dementia through an inflammatory condition. There's something called cerebellar ataxia. This is deterioration of the cerebellum responsible for balance and bladder control and other functions that deteriorates and shrinks. You can actually see it on an MRI or a CT scan. This is from the gliadin protein of wheat. It's an autoimmune process to the gliadin protein of wheat. We know that peripheral neuropathies can be caused by wheat. 50%, Doug, 50% of all unexplained peripheral neuropathies are caused by wheat and get better. That's yet another clinical trial that's been performed. When you take wheat out of the diet of people with peripheral neuropathy, unexplained peripheral neuropathy, they get better. Temporal lobe epilepsy is another condition of wheat consumption. You take wheat out of the diet, it improves. And I've seen that play out, by the way, in real life many times. So there are many facets of brain health affected by wheat. Multiple sclerosis, a disease not entirely but largely of wheat consumption. So the connection between many components in wheat and the brain is varied and often very scary.
Let's go back to the phones. Tim is joining us in Ogden. Tim, hi.
Hi there. Just had a question about other carbs. If I remove the wheat from my diet but I replace it with potatoes, squash, those kind of things, am I still going to lose my belly fat?
These are, and he's talking about starchy things or things that are higher in carbohydrates. Now, you write about this in the book that you still have to be careful with carbs, even if it's not wheat.
Yeah, you know, we arrived at a time, Doug, where over 70% of Americans are diabetic or pre-diabetic at the start of this process. So there's more to this than just wheat. In other words, I joke that if you stopped all wheat and relied on jelly beans and ice cream, you would still not be healthy. So we have to be careful about carbohydrate exposure. Now, we talked about that kind of self-limiting process. If you take wheat and thereby the gliadin protein, the opiates out of your life, you lose a lot of the desire for a lot of those starches. But some people do have a desire for those starches. And so if ideal health, full health is desired, most people, I would argue, do better by restricting other carbohydrates.
More and more people are calling themselves gluten-free, for example, buying these gluten-free foods. You say that's a problem. You have to be careful with gluten-free food.
Oh, thank you for raising that issue. Very, very important. So we don't want to replace a problem, wheat and gluten, with another problem. Gluten-free processed foods made with cornstarch, rice flour, tapioca starch, and potato starch. So those dried forms of pulverized starch raise blood sugar higher than even wheat. Very few foods raise blood sugar as high as whole wheat, except cornstarch, rice flour, tapioca starch, and potato starch. So I tell people, nobody should be eating those processed gluten-free foods. Now, gluten-free is not intrinsically bad. A cucumber is gluten-free, and that's perfectly fine. Or a lamb chop is gluten-free, and that's perfectly fine. So you can make gluten-free foods that are healthy. And that's part of what I do, by the way, with these cookbooks and so on, recipes. But we don't want what the food industry conceives of as gluten-free foods.
Let's take one more call from David in Salt Lake City. David, we don't have a lot of time, but welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to say it's been a really interesting conversation. Wheat's not the best thing in the world, but everything you're mentioning, dairy is implicated much further, and there's much wider knowledge base and peer-reviewed journal studies. I urge people to go to notmilk.com or Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM.org. You mentioned about 80% of...
David, I'm going to cut you off there just because your phone line is terrible. But I got the gist of it, which was he's talking about the fact that from his perspective, from David's perspective, everything that you're talking about, all these gastrointestinal issues, inflammation issues, can be related to dairy, that that's the real problem. How do you respond to that?
Well, Dairy is a problem. Dairy does have its own unique set of problems. So that's kind of a whole different conversation. I think some people can get by fine with dairy products. I think they should be full fat. I think they should be organic to minimize estrogen exposure, for instance. A lot of people have problems with the whey protein because it stimulates insulin release. Yeah. But
you're a big fan of cheese, too, it sounds like, in the book. Anyway.
Well, you know, I think we have to pick our battles, else we'll have nothing left on our plate. Yeah. So we have to pick the worst problems on the dinner plate. And the worst problems, I don't think, are dairy. Not to say there aren't problems with dairy. There's no question there are. My wife is miserably dairy intolerant, so we hardly have any dairy in our house. So it's not that just because it's not wheat, it must be good. But I want people to open their eyes and see the nutritional truth and nutritional stories for what they really are. And this notion of eat more healthy whole grains is not just ineffective. It is the most awful advice you could possibly follow.
Let me ask you this finally. In the future, you say the science of genetic modification has this potential to change wheat even further. You talk about how scientists no longer need to, you know, breed strains, for example. All they have to do is place a single gene or remove a single gene. So what is that going to mean for the future of wheat? And this question, couldn't we just strip out the bad stuff?
Well, you'd think the geneticists claim they can do such things. I can tell you they cannot. The science of genetics has advanced, but it remains a crude art. They cannot control what happens when they genetically modify a plant. You can't control where that gene goes, what chromosome. You can't control the epigenetics of that process, that is the control of the genes. So there's so much they still don't know. The problem is, you know, that's okay. That's the evolution of science. It has to start someplace. The problem is they see fit to sell it to you as food and see fit not to tell you about it, right? All that legislative action to fight us even having it on the food label. So there's nothing wrong with them trying to advance their science. It's that they sell it to us and won't tell us about it.
Dr. William Davis, he's a preventive cardiologist, author of the books Wheat Belly and Wheat Belly 30 Minutes or Less, the cookbook, which came out late last month. He joined us from a studio in Milwaukee. Dr. Davis, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music composed by The Moth and the Flame. Thanks also to Taylor Almond. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.